This is the second part of Cannibals for Dinner. When they arrived at the house, Russ met them at the door, helping them with umbrellas, taking wine from their hands, and leading them into the living room. There was April's friend, Dr. Dan Thomas. He was a tall, slender man with black-rimmed glasses and conservatively cropped hair. When they shook hands, he did not introduce himself as Doctor, and Ron liked that. He hated when Claire used Dr. Tuck, mostly when making reservations. She believed that it got them better service, while Ron believed that they expected bigger tips. Claire always told him, in complete sincerity, that she was proud of what he had accomplished, how hard he had worked for this title. Why shouldn't he use it? After all, it was his to use. Dan walked into the living room and sized him up, and Claire. He looked at Ron's shoulder-length hair and the scent of tobacco wafting around him. He could not help but be captivated by Claire's warm greeting. Any friend of April's would be a friend of hers. To Dan, these were April's friends, and long ago he was April's boyfriend, who knew his friends. They had mutual friends. Then life intervened. That was decades ago, and he wasn't sure if April was the allure, or if it was his youth that called to him. He wondered what April thought. From what Ron could grasp in his own sizing up of Dan, both Dan and April shared aging mothers and the problems that brings. For his birthday, he had sent her Keith Richards' autobiography. Dan and April had seen the Stones together in 1972. April loved Mick, and Keith was Dan's guy. She was tender and receptive, but that was her way. Russ was cordial in a way that Ron could not help but respect, but he was certain that Dan wondered who these people were and why they were important to April. Dan watched April and Ron kiss and took note of Claire's urgent desire to go upstairs to see Margaret. He also took in how April's eyes followed Ron, who was less than 6 feet tall, but combined a rough edge with a softness that Dan could not quite place. They were both at ease in the Crenshaw home, and there was an ease in having them there. Claire returned downstairs from visiting Margaret and handed April a gift bag. "Not a birthday," April said. "We have been wanting to give this to you," Claire said, stripping the birthday concoction that could be attached to it. A wise woman was Claire. April opened the bag, and her hands felt the soft silk inside the tissue paper in which it was wrapped. It was opaque, soft. She lifted it. It felt like a whisper. "I can sleep in this," she said, as if asking permission. "We practically live in ours sometimes," said Claire. Ron told her you could also wear them over jeans and a t-shirt. April smiled. "But I can sleep in it as well." "Happy on birthday," said Claire, with a kiss to April's cheek. "Coordinated colors for the t-shirt," said Ron. "No, bite your tongue." Ron complied and bit his tongue. "Something completely contrasting," said April. With the unbirthday presents out of the way, Russ poured everyone a glass of wine, announced that he was about to order pizza. As he said this, the back door opened and Dirk and Sabrina arrived, smiles all around. Ron could tell that Dan felt a bit left out. This was April's family and friends, and he didn't know them. He'd met Russ before, but that was many, many years ago. Sabrina approached him, a jerk to thumb in the direction of Dirk, and she said, "I'm Sabrina. I'm married to him." "She is my daughter-in-law," informed April. While wine was being poured and pizzas ordered, Ron took his turn to go and see Margaret. He climbed the picture-lined, heavy wooden stairs, hoping that when he reached the top, he would find her looking well and healthy. He knew that Claire would have reverted to her nursing background and performed a surreptitious examination. It would have been a light squeeze that was both tender and at the same time checking her muscle mass. A soft kiss that would allow Claire to check pupil regularity. She would then sweetly pepper her with questions that showed interest while measuring cognitive responses. If she was able to make Margaret laugh, she could measure the symmetry of her smile, check for signs of paralysis. Ron just wanted to talk to his friend Margaret. April had told him how much her mother adored him and Claire. Her favorite couple, she called them. He felt the same way about Margaret. It was mutual admiration. When he entered her room, she was lying on her left side, propped up on a pile of pillows. She lit up at the sight of him. He always made her laugh, and when she was strong enough to be downstairs, he always entertained her with stories that made her chuckle out loud. She remembered how she laughed when he told her about mistaking a building sign and believing it read Car Wash and Dental Center, and thinking that it was an odd place for a business venture. They kissed and she sat on the bed. She deadened the sound on the loud TV. "How are you feeling?" "I'm fine," she said. "I'm just stuck in this room since January. A pretty small world." "Well, maybe now that the weather is nicer," he offered to her. "I know I can make it downstairs, but coming back up would be a problem. So maybe next month, when my sons are here for my birthday, we can manage it." "April isn't very strong, you know," she said with a conspiratorial grin. At 95, Margaret's mind was sharp and mostly clear. It was her body that was wearing out. She hailed from hardy stock and was impatient with what had once been a gift. She couldn't get better. She just wanted it to be over. She wondered if God was keeping her alive because she was a pain in the ass and he didn't want her around heaven all the time. "Claire was pretty sick, wasn't she?" she said to Ron. "Yeah, 2 months. We were worried that she had done damage to her vocal cords." Margaret nodded. "I heard that she wasn't allowed to talk." 2 weeks," said Ron. "Did you like that?" laughed Margaret. "No, it was awful. She had a whiteboard and she wrote things down. Sometimes I tried to do both sides of the conversation for her, but we spend so much time together. She was miserable." "She seems better to me now," said Margaret. "She's getting there," said Ron. Russ yelled upstairs that the appetizers were being served. So Ron took his leave from Margaret, giving her a kiss and a hug, and a promise to see her again soon. Pizza at the Crenshaws was not exactly a slice served on styrofoam. It began with appetizers that included clams casino, empanadas, and cheese puffs. Russ explained that these were finally the leftovers of the last New Year's Eve. He had pulled them out of the oven and placed them on trivets. Their kitchen was a mixture of new and old, with a center island, but an older sink and a tin ceiling. They circled around the island, a dance with fingers and forks and food. "I've been thinking more about the cannibal discussion," said Ron. Smiles greeted the announcement. He hadn't realized that Dan had not been part of the original discussion, and April quickly brought him up to speed. "Do you think that there is a connection between them and the vampire craze? Is there really any difference between the two?" To his surprise, April said, "I think there is." "I agree," said Dan. "Vampires aren't real." "But there are people who drink blood, and since they aren't immortal, aren't they just cannibals?" "I think there is a difference," said April. The idea of eating flesh was never high on my taste bud list. But drinking blood is, said Ron. April held her hand in back of her closely cropped brown hair and said, Well, it is nourishment, which we all need to survive, and doesn't sucking blood somehow seem sensuous? She delicately and deliberately, with a tiny fork, picked at the breaded stuffing of a clam on its shell. She popped it into her mouth. Now, where's the blood? She asked. At that moment, as if it was orchestrated, the appetizers disappeared, and people wandered into the living room. Russ followed with two bowls of freshly peeled shrimp for the second course of pizza night at the Crenshaws. As they sat down, April said, My brother sent me an interesting book for a present a few years ago. I just came across it the other day and thought of you, Ron, in particular. It's called How Far Will You Go? I think we'd have a great time playing it. I suggested to Muriel when I first got it, but she chickened out. Claire pointed at Ron. You want to play that with him? Are you crazy? Have you totally lost your mind? We're talking Ron here. They both laughed. April believed the game wouldn't be fun with safe people. What would be the point of playing? She thought they were a perfect group for such an adventure. When April and Claire were glancing over the book, Ron turned on his heel and headed for the front door. In 2013, it was unthinkable to ask anyone if they minded if you smoked. One just went outside. Claire, once upon a time, not very long ago, used to join him. He knew after her illness she wouldn't be coming back. What he didn't know was that April objected to having people sent outside in order to smoke. She had once been a heavy smoker and understood the addiction. As a reformed, or was it recovering, smoker, she didn't mind smokers at all, except in the close confines of a car. That she hated. This was always a point of contention between Russ and her. He hated smoking, end of story. He used to send his mother outside in the middle of winter to smoke her one cigarette a day. It infuriated her when he did that, and she let him know it. As Ron opened the front door on the rain and lit his cigarette, he glanced at the flag holder that had caused such merriment a while back at the Crenshaws. He had both horrified and amused Russ by saying that it looked like a phallic symbol. The metal holder jutted out straight and strong. Ron inhaled on his cigarette and grinned as he exhaled the smoke into the night air. The last time he was here for pizza night, he had dubbed the delivery service overpriced pizza when two pies had cost $43. He thought it extravagant, unless the pizza was stupendous. It was not. He had paid the tab, much to Russ's chagrin. He knew that Russ considered them guests, and guests were not expected to pay for their dinner. When the car stopped outside, he thought, I can't be this lucky twice in a row. But the delivery man stepped out of the car, carrying the overpriced pizza. This time, Russ had ordered four pies. The tab was $65. Ron gleefully reached into his pocket and handed over 70. He had gotten another one over on Russ, or so he thought. Do you want change, said the delivery man. Ron shook his head and said, nah. He walked back to the house, or parachuted in, four pies in hand. Russ jumped up and they met in the kitchen. Where's the delivery guy? He left. No, no, said Russ. You are not going to pay for overpriced pizza again. He thrust $80 at Ron. I don't have a 10, said Ron. I'll have to owe you. Russ liked this idea, and Ron was amused by it. It was fun to play about money, because neither of them was stingy. This was something that had been right between them all along. They had the same feelings about money. It was to be used for friends and shared. It was never something to disagree about. They both liked it this way and found it another piece of which they understood about each other. During the pizza and salad course of the dinner, they moved into the dining room. Ron saw that the table was set with matching china plates, good plates, from what he could tell, and spun gold wine glasses from Italy, with an interesting story attached to them. In true Ron fashion, he snuck over and found a stack of paper plates and swapped his china plate for a paper one. It was a Ron thing to do and passed without comment for about 30 seconds when April saw that her table was not quite right. "Ronald," she said in a threatening tone of voice that April used only on him, "what are you doing?" He looked up and feigned innocence. April frowned at Russ. "There weren't enough plates." Russ seemed confused and stammered. "I was sure that I counted them out. I'll get another." Before Russ could get up and go to the kitchen, Ron laughed and confessed, "Okay, I'm busted. I did it." Still, Russ was up and exchanging plates for April's benefit. She relaxed now, knowing the table setting was casual, yet elegant. Ron felt a moment of guilt that he had caused, that he discerned as tension in April when she noticed the mismatched plate. He wondered to himself if she had known it was Ron's doing all along, would she have been amused? When she thought it was Russ, she had found no humor in it. Married couples, the tension, like the rod in the car with Claire. Do we constantly test each other's limits? Now that they were sitting down at the dinner table, conversation was easier. Flowing back and forth, to and fro, he asked Dirk if things got hectic at the theater this time of the year. Dirk nodded, his shaved head glistening from the overhead chandelier. Graduations, recitals, lots of local schools use the theater for various events. Does it slow down afterwards? Yes, in July and August it gets slow, and I get to catch my breath. Catch up on some reading and TV that I've missed. Can I make a recommendation? Said Ron. Hearing this, Russ leaned over to his son and said, "You know that he's going to recommend some communist liberal trash, right?" The three of them were laughing. Ron knew that April called her stepson, with the greatest affection, "my favorite anarchist," and had given him a Che Guevara t-shirt one year. Dirk shook his head. "No, I want something interesting to watch and read." Ron made eye contact with Russ and then turned to Dirk. "Have you seen any of the series Newsroom?" "Never heard of it." "It's horrible liberal propaganda," said Russ, and they pat themselves on the back. "The star of the show plays a Republican," said Ron. "A thinking Republican, which, as we all know, is a rarity." "We actually did see a couple of episodes, and I like Jeff Daniels as an actor. But I'm not really a Republican," said Russ, with a puckish grin. "I would agree," said Claire. "I see you as more of a libertarian." Russ gave her a full-blown smile. "They have forged a friendship." "That's right," he said. Ron tossed his setup pitch to Claire. "Some people actually like my recommendations." Claire grinned. She didn't and wouldn't take the bait, but she knew that wasn't going to stop him. "Tell them how many books that I have recommended to you that you have actually read in the last 3 decades. "Not many," said Claire. "All the more reason to pass on the Newsroom debacle," said Russ jokingly. "It's Aaron Sorkin," said Ron, as if the name would carry some weight. "Exactly," said Russ. always writing the liberal fantasy land. To change this topic, as a hostess is obliged to do on such occasions, April stated, "I'm reading a book that Ron recommended." Ron looked at Claire with a sincere but teasing grin. "See, this is why I need a second wife." "What book?" asked Dan, who until now had pretty much remained a silent observer. All understandable, but odd, since he was usually a talker. "Back to Blood," said Ron. Was it coincidental that their conversation in the kitchen had been about blood? Dan shook his head in a gesture of non-recognition. He had just recently told April that with surgery, kids, and isolated life in South Jersey, he had fallen way behind in what current reading material was out there. It wasn't a lack of interest so much as a lack of time and isolation. She thought this was why he was quiet and observing the interactions of the group. "It's Tom Wolfe," said Ron. "You know, The Right Stuff, Bonfire of the Vanities, and A Man in Full." "I know who he is," said Dan with a tinge of defensive sarcasm. "I do read." Ron didn't respond, but left it hanging in the air. He thought to himself, would I have asked the luscious Sabrina that question? And he knew he would not have put her on the spot, as he had with Dan. April was having none of this. She could sense it, and instead she started telling a Ron story to the table at large. One night at Claire and Ron's house, Ron had, one of the very few times I've witnessed, a little too much to drink. He was talking about the horrors of Guantanamo, and although she wasn't convinced the soccer fields, prayer rugs, and copies of Koran and special food was horrible torture, she agreed with him on the matter of closing it down. But Ron kept arguing the point, as if he hadn't noticed that they had reached agreement. And then, out of nowhere, he said, "I do have a doctorate in humanities, you know." Ron blushed as everyone at the table had a good laugh at his expense. "I really said that?" He looked at Claire, who was nodding with a huge smile on her face. "Which goes to prove that too much alcohol can make you into a pretentious asshole." Everyone, including Dan, laughed at this. "I really said that?" People ate with conviviality, relaxed in the Crenshaw home, relaxed with each other. Ron was driving home and stopped after the second glass of wine, drank glass after glass of ice water from one of the crystal pitchers set on the table. Conversation continued on. "I think you'll enjoy the Keith Richards autobiography," said Dan to April. "What's the line?" said Claire. "Happy to be here? Happy to be anywhere?" Everyone laughed. "He's really a very intelligent man," said Dan. Ron asked, "Does he write about getting his blood swapped out in Switzerland?" "He writes honestly about being a drug addict," said Dan. "He comes right out and admits it." "Well, be kind of hard for him to deny it at this point, don't you think?" quipped Ron. April, wondering why this male stuff was about her table, interjected, "Can they actually do that?" She wanted her friends to all get along, to love each other the way that she loved each and every one of them. She knew that Ron was testing Dan, and she didn't exactly know why. "Who knows what they do in Switzerland? I suppose they might have hooked him up to a dialysis machine and tried to clean out his kidneys or something," said Dan. "Isn't that what they do with rapid detox?" said Claire. "It could be one of the things, yes." "Claire was a nurse for 20 years, said April, looking at Claire for confirmation of the fact. To Ron, it didn't appear that Dr. Dan acknowledged the statement. Ron, because of Claire, had been around a lot of doctors in social situations. It never ceased to amaze him that doctors oftentimes did not consider nurses to be colleagues. They thought of them more in the way that teachers look at the school janitor. They were there to clean up after the actual work was done. Again, April felt Ron's criticism towards Dan's lack of response, and again, she shifted to more neutral ground. "You really should bring your wife the next time you are up this way," said April. "Do you think that she'll be able to handle this group?" Again, it didn't appear that Dan responded. There were a few seconds of silence, which were broken when Sabrina started asking when the summer was finally going to arrive. This lack of warmth was killing her Caribbean blood, as she called it. While the discussion continued in response to Sabrina's statement, Dan stood up from the table, wandered into the living room. April slipped away and walked over to Dan. They talked quietly for a few more minutes, and both returned to the dining room. "I've got to skedaddle," said Dan to everyone seated. Dan wasn't quite sure that they heard the comment above the talking, and repeated his skedaddle phrase. April laughed and asked, "Do you have a curfew?" Dan explained to the table that he had a 91-year-old mother with whom he was staying the night. April took him upstairs to see her mom for a few minutes and then walked him to the door, and he was gone. When she returned to the table, April said, "I think Dan has been spending too much time in South Jersey." For a state as small as New Jersey, the disparity between the North and South was pronounced. It might only take 2.5 hours to journey from tip to toe, but the cultural disparities were enormous. It was also that way between eastern and western New Jersey. Each extreme seemed to have as much allegiance to the bordering state as it did to New Jersey itself. South Jersey was code for a certain lack of openness and sophistication. There was also a pronounced political conservatism that was far more popular in the South than in the central and northeastern parts of the state. It really was the country in microcosm. Horse farms and cows in the West, appendages of New York City in the East, a connected spiral of suburbs branching out from the cities, the resort towns along the coast, pine barrens and swamps dotting the state. They were all New Jersey people. They had all endured the "what exit are you from" jokes and the misconception that everyone from New Jersey knew at least one soprano. Ron and Claire actually did. They had grown up in separate cities but were born and raised around the people who had nicknames that had made them seem like connected members of mafia families. Most of all, the TV exposure of New Jersey in fiction was all about crime families. That's what people thought when they thought of New Jersey. These were Ron's thoughts as he drove home that night following April's unbirthday. Again, they ended the evening at home with notes back and forth, letting April know that they had arrived safely, wishing her a now actual happy birthday. Just 1 week later, it was time for another dinner with the Crenshaws, this time a belated birthday celebration for Ron.